Today is Monday, July 19th, 2010. I'm Brad Pepping, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. Today on the show, we bring you an interview with Alma Mater Society President Bijan Ahmadian and VP Administration Ekaterina Jovenko about the recent selection of architecture firm for the new Student Union building, a $103 million project. We'll also bring you the most recent edition of Groundwire, focusing on First Nations stories and resistance. In addition, we will be speaking with Justin Langeal in our ongoing weekly collaboration with the Tai.ca, BC's independent online magazine. All of this, plus your weekday weather forecast and arts report, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. But first, here are the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some 20,000 HIV experts and advocates are in Vienna today, where a week-long international conference on AIDS is underway. AIDS 2010 Chair Julio Montaner said yesterday that G8 nations have not kept up with promises to fund universal access to treatment programs and warned that dire consequences could result. A study led by Montaner and published in yesterday's Lancet found a direct correlation between increased HIV treatment and decreased transmission. And another study, to be released by the CDC at the conference, finds that in the United States, poverty, not race, is the most common denominator in urban transmission rates. When five African-American police officers in Washington, D.C. complained about racial discrimination, their boss retaliated. A jury has now ruled in their favor. Tanya Snyder reports.
A jury has found that commanding officer Ronald Wilkins punished the five officers for filing a racial discrimination complaint. The complaint was anonymous, but according to the Washington Examiner, Wilkins figured out who it was and started withholding information the officers needed to do their jobs. When they took the next step in the complaint, all five officers were taken out of the elite unit they worked in and demoted. Chris Bauman is the head of D.C.'s police union.
That is unfortunately sort of standard procedure right now within this police department. The officials in the department, particularly the high-ranking officials, simply don't understand how the law and rules are supposed to work, and frankly, I don't think they care.
Despite a department reprimand for dereliction of duty and lying to investigators, Lieutenant Wilkins has since been promoted. The city now has to pay $900,000 to be divided among the five officers. A police spokeswoman says the department will appeal the decision. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
An ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee says British Secret Service accounts of his interrogations are wrong. He's one of six former detainees suing the British government for its role in their secret rendition. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
These highly classified documents were released through the High Court as part of the ongoing case against the government and the security services. Omar Deguez, one of those six men, says the notes the government has given the court are incomplete because they show only one record of an interview with UK agents in Guantanamo. Deguez claims there were three or four meetings. He also says the notes leave out all the specific complaints he made about ill treatment, starvation and beatings. He says one attack by a prison guard was so brutal he was left blind in one eye. The British government has always denied involvement in so-called extraordinary rendition and torture of terrorism suspects, but these documents suggest direct involvement. Mr. De Gea's allegations increase the pressure on the government to appoint an independent judge to decide whether the notes have been legitimately blacked out. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Irish President Mary McAleese signed a civil union measure into law today. The civil partnership bill will allow unmarried domestic partners, both gay and straight, to register and receive marriage-like legal rights. The measure will not take effect until after updates are made to the nation's tax and public assistance laws, most likely early next year. In Gaza, Hamas has banned women from publicly smoking water pipes. Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Hamas authorities say that the ban is meant to preserve the social and religious values of Gaza conservative community. Gaza's 1.6 million residents have been locked down inside the Gaza Strip for 3 years, with severe restrictions on the movement of people and goods alike. Across Gaza, particularly at seaside resorts and big coffee shops, men and women enjoy smoking a water pipe as a deviation from the restrictions created by the Israeli blockade. Riham Al-Halabi, who wears a head covering, is a university graduate. She was socializing with some friends at the Delicious Store, one of the major coffee shops in Gaza City.
This decision contradicts our entire society, where women or girls may have their own personal motives or reasons. Yet it seems that this decision is binding. Therefore, we will witness more repression of women's freedoms.
The water pipe ban for women is the latest in a string of restrictions imposed over the past 3 years. For example, females are not allowed to ride on motorbikes and should wear special uniforms at schools. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Iraq today, bombs continue to kill. 4 are dead in Baqubah, 1 in Mosul. Yesterday, 3 separate bombings killed as many as 51 people, most of whom were members of the Awakening Council, a U.S.-funded group that turned on al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Awakening Council was established as a U.S.-sponsored alternative to insurgency. In 2008, Iraqi officials took over responsibility for the council, but many promised civilian jobs have yet to materialize, and they say they are often paid late when they're paid at all. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And as always, we do thank FSRN for making those headlines available to us, and we encourage our listeners to come back 1 week from today. We will have those headlines from FSRN on our show again. But if you want to check out FSRN.com, you can check out their daily feature, which is news from around the world, which is really impressive. We're now going to turn to our ongoing weekly collaboration with the Tai.ca, which is BC's independent online magazine. And I'm joined with Justin Langille over the phone. Justin, thanks so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to jump into it. Unfortunately, we're a little short on time today, so we want to move through some of this content really quickly because it is really interesting and we want to get to as much as we can. So with a sensational new billboard condemning the Alberta tar sands and comparing them to the Gulf oil spill, we have a couple stories today about the tar sands. First, we'll jump to Mitchell Anderson, who is once again pointing us back to the Burrard Inlet and the horrifying possibility of a tanker spill along the BC coast. So, Justin, could you fill us in on the history of Anderson's recent articles concerning the regulations of tug crew sizes? And where are we now with the July 16th article, Reg Still Tight on Tug Crew Sizes, says Transport Canada?
Well, you know, what Mitchell's doing here is he's really doing some studious sort of discussion around, you know, what's actually being done within our waters to protect the eventual possibility of an oil spill from a tanker within our waters in the Burrard Inlet. And so he's actually going and doing some of the footwork that not a lot of other journalists do. And he's asking, you know, who's manning the tugs and how many people are manning the tugs, and you know, what are the rigorous sort of practices and rules around that that Transport Canada has in place. And through his discussions, he's discovered that there's various ways in which you know, people realize these should be made. Transport Canada says that, you know, in some instances, you know, two-man crews are out there manning them, that four-man crews are always out there manning them. But other people are saying, that Mitch has talked to, that in some instances it's only two-man crews, which leaves a lot of room for human error.
And so I guess the history of his articles have been that it was, if you can remind our listeners, somebody involved with the tug crew operation was saying that to safely dock or unload a tugboat, only two crew members are needed, but when it's actually traveling or transporting, it needs to have those four crew members. But it's that weird discrepancy where once a tugboat is, you know, off, there's still only two people on it. And so Transport Canada was responding to that. And I guess in the most recent mm-hmm. article, they were saying, if there is any information, we do want to follow up on it.
Exactly.
And so it just seems like Mitchell Anderson seems to be trying to cover a story where there is a lot of hostility and people are getting upset about what could be happening.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is valuable work given, you know, what's happened recently with the oil spill in the Gulf, and you know, to safeguard our waters and to make sure the same thing doesn't happen here. I think that this is, you know, this is what needs to be done, and this is the kind of public information that we need to be talking about. So that's where I feel like, you know, some of our strong points have been with regards to this in the last little while.
And so obviously us at CITR News, we're happy to, you know, go back to the tie-in. We always catch Mitchell Anderson's recent posts, and I'm sure that we'll be able to go back there soon enough to see a follow-up story on what's happening with these tugboats.
Indeed.
But on that note, I want to jump back to the tar sands, and maybe we could talk a little bit about Andrew Nekifuruk, who is the tie's first and first staff writer. And Andrew joins the tie's ranks as the as a writer of a column or a segment, sorry, about energy and equity. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the motivation for the tie to gain their first staff writer, and why Andrew?
Sure. Well, you know, our interest in what's going on in the tar sands are just sort of obvious. You know, it's one of the most pressing issues that we have facing Canada today, in my opinion, along with, you know, what's going on with our foreign inclinations towards Afghanistan and Iraq, and what's happening in you know, the tar sands. We feel that, you know, just because we're BC-centric news service doesn't mean that we can't understand and devote a lot of time and manpower into what's going on in you know, in Alberta to a great extent. And by bringing in Andrew, we've really you know, made a sort of stride towards doing that. And so he'll be writing an energy and equity column for us in the months to come, and he's the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, and he's known by our editor's own sort of iteration as being the senior muckraker of what's going on in the tar sands, and the journalist in Canada who's doing some of the most thorough investigative work around this. So we want to, you know, sort of dovetail what's going on with our journalists Jeff Dembicki and Mitch, and want to sort of extend our reach into investigative work on the tar sands, because it's an issue that affects you know, Canadians just probably, you know, for the next 10 years, if not more, infinitely.
And so I really like when you say that he's our senior muckraker, because not only does that imply, you know, what he is doing in the tar sands, but he is very much senior, and which is really emphasized in his first story on the tie, which is the cover story about the shredded documents from the Standing Committee on Environmental and Sustainable Development, which was that tar sands panel that was trying to discover what was happening in terms of the impact on the environment there. And he detailed very extensively and very thoughtfully what was happening, why those documents were shredded, but then also what those documents were contained. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could just tell us some of the highlights of that article, because obviously it's a very lengthy and very interesting article, but just to get through some of the meatier bits of it.
Sure, yeah, some of the details, you know, therein of that report that he went and he sussed out, you know, after he found that that it was being destroyed, is, you know, it have to do with the leaking and seeping of the tailing ponds that collect the used wastewater from the extraction process. So, you know, once the oil is being, it's having the sand extracted out of it, there's these massive tailing ponds that contain, you know, water that's just, you know, polluted with radioactive material, with, you know, dirty oil. And there's potential for that to pollute major aquifers in Alberta and major streams that surrounding communities depend on. And so he detailed that, as well as, you know, what the implications of this are for climate change. And that being that, you know, we're one of we're now one of the biggest producers of oil in the world, and we don't have our own concrete policies on climate change, and the water that we're going to be using is going to further deplete water that's is anyway going to evaporate. So there's implications there for for the resource uses that we're putting into the tar sands that anyways human beings need to use. And going on, he details the pollution to to a great extent on to what extent heavy metals will kill fish in the surrounding areas that First Nations populations depend on, as well as other people.
And so obviously this is a great start to this type of collaboration that he'll have with the Tai. And can we expect a daily or a weekly feature from him on the Tai.ca?
From what I know right now, it's going to be as per his per his writing. So right. So when columns come about, that's when they're going to appear. I think as they become more regular, it's going to be a bi-weekly.
Right. Okay.
Feature. Yeah. That's to my knowledge right now. I can give you an update on that next week. But for now, that's what we know. And it's really pertinent. In his interview with David Beers, he talks about energy slavery and the fact that now that we're coming to this point where we're using oil continually after we know what the problems are with our dependence on it. It's revealing a real addiction and something that we maybe don't have control of anymore.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us again today, Justin. We really appreciate hearing about these two stories. And for our listeners and for Tai readers, we do definitely recommend that you go to the Tai.ca to check out what's happening. And Justin, we look forward to speaking with you in 1 week's time.
Thanks very much. You guys have a nice week.
That was Justin Langeal of the Tai.ca. And if you want to check out BC's independent online magazine, go to the Tai.ca, which is Tetyee.ca. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for a live in-studio interview with AMS President Bijan Amadian and VP Administration Ekaterina Dovzhenko about the recent selection of an architecture firm for the new student union building, a $103 million project, and it's definitely going to involve all the students on campus. So make sure that you stick around for that. That's in a matter of seconds right here on CITR News on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building in Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Well, the sun's going down with its deep umber light, embracing the town as we fall into night.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support Public Dreams Society in the 2010 Illuminari's Lantern Procession Journey to a New World on July 24th from 4 to 10 p.m. at the W2 Storium at 151 West Cordova Street. It will be a departure from years past in its new location, but remains a celebration of community, art, and light spreading through W2 Storium's large indoor spaces and out into Trounce Alley and around the Woodward site. For more information, visit publicdreams.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Brad Pepink in studio with Andrew Longhurst as my producer, and I'm happy to be joined by Bijan Amadian and Ekaterina Dovzhenko. Bijan is the AMS president, and Ekaterina is the AMS... can you actually tell them?
VP admin.
And so I'm joined in studio with them to chat about what's happening on campus. And first, we're going to chat about the new sub building. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's been happening to fill in our listeners. Back in the day, we had an architect selection, and that was narrowed down to a few. And then there was a negotiation process. And where are we now?
So we started with the architect selection process in April, and that was basically a student-wide vote. We had about 2,400 students come in, and they voted three architect firms, so Bing Tom Architects, Busby Perkins and Will, and then lastly HBBH plus BH. From then onwards, we issued a request for proposals, so a formalized request for their proposals, and they brought those in. We did technical scoring as well as office visits and interviews. And lastly, we've chosen our architect.
And that architect is maybe Bijan. You can tell us about why HBBH plus BH is our new the new architect firm that's going to be designing our student union building.
So we are very excited about HBBH and BH. There are a couple of things I would tell you about them. One of them is one of the values that students care a lot about when it comes to this building is sustainability. And this firm showed that they had a very pragmatic, innovative approach to sustainability. Another important element for us was student engagement. This is supposed to be a very student-driven process. And this firm showed that they had really creative ideas when it came to student engagement. For example, they are going to create a permanent design cube in the current SOP in the South Alcove, just so that students can go and visit and give feedback. And they're going to have a beer and pizza night every second Friday.
All right. And so that's just to get student feedback on what's going on?
Yeah.
So maybe you can tell us about some of the stats. We're expecting the building to open by 2014. How feasible is that? What are we thinking?
All right. Do you want me to take that one, Bijan?
Sure.
So yes, the opening date is 2014, mostly in late August, beginning of September, and construction will be beginning in 2012. It's a pretty big building, and it's going to be located kind of right beside the Aquatic Center, and it will most likely add on to the existing sub. It'll be about 250,000 square feet, and will encompass a lot of really great program in terms of different areas for students, student engagement, and things like that. It's cited to be about $103 million. And it's also in terms of sustainability, it will target for LEED Platinum.
And so maybe you can tell us about some of the things that we were concerned about, or as a student body we were concerned about back in the day, in terms of what we can expect for a bus loop and what we can also expect for different services in the new building, in terms of what can we can the Norm Theater staying in the current sub, and also the current sub, what its use is going to be. Do we have any idea where that's going to be moving?
So currently the university is in the process of putting together a transportation plan, and our VP Academic and University Affairs has a seat, and we have a strong voice on that committee. And essentially what AMS has been pushing for is that we would like the new sub to be that place that gives people a sense of arrival, that they get off the bus and they see the new sub and they say, now I've arrived at UBC. But the plans for that are still haven't been finalized. As far as the spaces like the Norm Theater goes, those are some of the issues that will be determined and more figured figured out in details as we go through the design process during the first semester. And that's so one of the most exciting part of this is that the schematics for this building are supposed to be going to Board of Governors for Board 2 approval in January 2011. And so students have the opportunity to give feedback on how they want this building to look like between September and December, and that's when a very creative, strong, innovative student engagement campaign will be going on to bring those kind of ideas from students.
Yeah, so the 4 months that we're really coming to are going to be the 4 months that are probably the most important when it comes to the overall look of the building. So students will be able to have their say on how they want the building to look for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I hate to do this to you guys, but as we have you in studio, bringing up the price tag of $110 million and $25 million of that coming from the UBC and then $85 million coming through student fees, I was hoping that we could take a few seconds to just chat about what's been going on campus in terms of the AMS budget and it going through, or it not going through rather, the voting procedure. So I was just hoping that maybe we could chat about what's most recently been happening. You could maybe fill us in on some of the things that went down. And it's funny, just for those who can't see what we're doing in studio, the Bijan and Ekaterina are discussing who should take this question. But I was just wondering, maybe Bijan, first you could respond to what's been happening over the blogosphere and UBC media in terms of some of the hostility and the antagonism and the just downright anger that's been going on with this budget and where we stand with it.
Let me start there. Council has approved the budget as presented, but only temporary and as an operational framework that is supposed to keep us going business as usual until the next council meeting, which is scheduled for August the 11th. I have had an opportunity to meet with several councillors, and the budget has been resent now, and a budget workshop has been scheduled for this coming Thursday, where councillors have been invited to come and chat about different areas that they're concerned about. In addition to that, our VP Finance has sent out a doodle poll asking for councillors to come and meet with him personally if they would like to have one-on-one meetings with him. The biggest concern, I would say, that came up at council was, can we still afford to have the block party, if we approve this budget? So the events department and I have put a bit of an urgency on putting together the plans for block party, and I've just received a new budget for it. We're working on explaining how the budget works, and I expect to send it to council tomorrow so that they, when they come in for the budget workshop on Thursday, we have some material to talk about, and then we will bring it on August 11th. One of the main priority this year for me as the president is to make sure that council works as a team, and that's one of the focuses of several conversations that's taken place, is how do we create an environment in which council feels that they have an ownership of the society, and at the same time the executives feel that council trusts their judgment and comes to them with problems, because we have really highly competent executive team this year that can bring value to students, but we can only do that best if council and executives are working together as a team.
And so obviously the block party issue, there was a great deal of confusion as towards what was going down with it, because some people were saying it was just an omission, it was just a slight, but it's great to hear that it is being addressed and that something will be resolved. I was hoping that if we could take the chance now, that maybe you could respond to some of the criticism that has been a bit more personal about the budget in terms of the slush funds towards AMS Executive Council. And so the one thing that I was able to get garner from most of the blogosphere and most of the UBC media and just some of the chatter going around on campus is, how I'm going to try to put it, is that first and foremost, AMS executives are students, and that should be reflected in their operation. However, the budget is claiming that execs work full time as AMS employees and should therefore receive coverage under a different healthcare plan. So I was wondering if you could just, either of you, invite you both to comment on this, respond to critics asking why isn't the student health plan enough for AMS executives, and whether or not AMS executives are shirking their responsibility to serve students, and whether or not they're...
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because when you look at the AMS, there's six full-time employees that are not on the extended health and dental plan that the rest of our staff are. And we, all the six of us, work 40 hours a week. That's the five executives plus the executive coordinator of student services. One of the things that, everyone, not many people know, is that recently we went to a conference called Leaders Hall, and one of the things that we noticed is that our executives have probably the most complex job of any student executives across the country. For example, this year we negotiated not just a sub agreement, but we're also negotiating our union agreement. We are renewing our extended health and dental plan agreement and a UPass agreement. And what's interesting about this is that the executives are doing this. It's not our general manager or the senior management team that's doing this, in contrast to other universities. Vancouver is one of the most expensive cities to live in, but when you look at the salaries, we get paid the least of any other student executives in the country, and we actually don't typically work 40 hours a week. Ben was reporting to me that our VP academic at University of that he worked 65 hours last week. And so one of the things we've recognized is that health and wellness is a key part of making sure that you have a productive executive that can bring value when we're dealing with, you know, such complex jobs. And if you either pay for these things now or you pay for them later in lost productivity. It's a very common thing in organizations now that they provide this wellness budget to their executives to give them a bit of a nudge. It's not something you can receive in cash, but if you spend it on wellness activities, then you can be reimbursed for it. To kind of give that nudge to the executive, say, you know what, take some time off and make sure you're spending it on your wellness. And one thing to keep in mind is that on top of that, we are all required to be in school, so people are taking one or two courses at the same time. And it's a pretty hectic, complex lifestyle, and so I'm fairly defensive about this.
All right. Well, thank you very much for commenting on that, Bijan. I really do appreciate it. And thank you both for coming down. I was hoping maybe we could go to last word to Ms. Dovzhenko, and you can fill us in. How do you feel about the sub and our next steps from here?
I am extremely excited about the new sub. I think the new sub building will be more than a building. It will really allow students to have a home away from home. It will bring commuters, students to a central place. It has a great space in terms of the siting of the place. And now that we've had the architect on board, we have kind of the beginnings of design and the beginnings of a great student engagement process.
All right. Well, thanks again for both coming down and speaking
thanks
to
so
us
much.
Today. I do appreciate
thank you for
it.
Having us.
And we're going to jump to a quick break now, but thanks again to Bijan and Ekaterina for joining me in studio. You're hearing us live broadcasting from the Student Union Building at CITR 101.9 FM on the FM dial. So obviously we do care greatly about what's going to be happening with the new sub, or you're also hearing us streaming online at CITR.ca. And we're now going to jump over to our friend Adam Janusz, the arts report on CITR News. Here's Adam.
Hello, this is the News 101 Arts Report for Monday, July 19th. I'm Adam Janusz. This past weekend was the 33rd annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival, and CITR had a large contingent doing not only a live broadcast, but interviews with performers, festival goers, and vendors. One such interview was with Shane Koizan. He's the spoken word artist who recently performed at the Olympic Games here in Vancouver in February. At the time, Shane expressed some mixed feelings about accepting the Olympic job. Even though having an audience of over a billion people is great, he didn't know whether he wanted to support such a large corporate entity. But here's how he feels about it today.
You said that before that you were kind of conflicted about whether to accept the Olympics, spotlight or not. Now that it's several months later, have you kind of any closer to kind of reconciling how you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm glad I did it. You know, the bottom line, you know, my grandmother probably, you know, put it best. You know, she said, once you say no, that's it. It's gone forever. And on it, like, the chance to perform at the Olympics comes around once in a lifetime, unless you're a multi-platinum selling artist, like, but for a poet, all right, yeah, I'll do it.
And I think also to see spoken word on that kind of stage was pretty, it really changed how people saw that genre, which I think is really important for other spoken word artists too. I mean, it's, you know, just another step towards getting it more recognized.
So you as a fellow artist did not look at him at the Olympics and say, how dare he betray us artists by selling out to the man?
No, not at all.
She saw dollar signs.
No, I mean, I think the more great art that comes out of anywhere is, you know, like, I mean, that's, if it's quality, it's quality. And I think something like the Olympics is a platform to be able to do something really quality at. And yeah, Coke sponsored it, but, you know, Naya sponsors this. Like, I don't know, like, whatever. It's, I don't know. That wasn't very eloquent, but yeah.
So in terms of the way you kind of see day-to-day life and the stuff that inspires your poetry, then you're not, you know, post-Olympics, you're not sort of thinking how you're going to, what are you going to write about now that you have a big limo and that you're swimming in a pool of money? That sort of thing is just not...
Do people actually think that? Yeah. God, I drive a Honda Civic, you know? It's like, no, it's not all Rolls Royces and whatnot. I do well enough. Yeah, thanks. I do well enough that I can support myself. I can go see a movie if I want to see a movie, but there's not much beyond that. I think... I forgot what the question was.
Just the Olympics and how it's changed you. Basically, it has...
The thing that's changed the most for me is that people now have a frame of reference for what spoken word is. So when they hear, oh, I'm going to a spoken word show, okay, now we kind of know what it is. So that's been the best thing about it. Because before, trying to get people out to a show was, you know, you'd have to be a lover of literature or, like, the fans that I've had in, like, all along the way, they'd seen me grow throughout that sort of time period, so they knew already. But I think now other people might be more inclined to go out and see a spoken word event or to go see, you know, some live poetry, which is great.
You can catch the rest of my interview with Shane Koizan on Wednesday's Arts Report at 5 p.m. As well, you'll be able to hear some highlights from CITR's coverage of the Folk Festival this weekend. So join us Wednesday at 5 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM. Now back to the news.
And as always, we do thank Adam for that report, and make sure that you do check out the Arts Report on Wednesday, because it's going to be pretty rad. The Folk Fest this past weekend was a great place. I'm glad that we got to see some CITR fans down on the grounds. The current time is 5:37, and that means it's time for our weekday weather forecast. And for that, we jump to Daniel Casanova. And Daniel, hope that you can fill us in on what we can expect for this week.
Sure, Brad. Well, expect another week of summer weather. High temperatures will be in the low 20s, and weather conditions for the fireworks shows will be optimal. Here's your forecast. Monday evening to the overnight, it will be clear with high clouds starting around midnight with a low of 14 degrees. For Tuesday, we will have high clouds throughout the day, but expect the sun to still shine through. High of 22 degrees, low of 16. On Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high of 24 degrees and low of 16, making it perfect conditions for viewing the fireworks. For Thursday, we will have cloudy periods with 30% chance of isolated showers. High of 22, low of 15 degrees. For Friday, it will be sunny with a high of 24 and low of 14 degrees. On Saturday, we will have a mix of sun and clouds. High of 23, low of 15. And for Sunday, it will be sunny with a high of 23 degrees, low of 15. Currently, it is 20 degrees and sunny at the airport. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
And as always, we do thank Daniel and the Storm Club of UBC for providing that forecast, and we hope that our listeners enjoy that, because that is user-generated weather, which is really, really, really rad. And so we thank Daniel for gathering all that information. We're now going to jump to Groundwire, news radio program featuring headlines, reports, and features from the community radio sector in Canada. And I'm afraid to say that we have run a little bit of overtime. I was a little bit too ambitious with my questions for our AMS counselors, and so unfortunately Groundwire may run a little bit over, but I encourage you to go to the NCRA webpage to catch the full broadcast of Groundwire, and we also hope to bring you the full broadcast of this Groundwire edition on our Friday show, which is right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Friday at 5 p.m. in Vancouver. And I'm going to end the show there. That is our program for July 19th, 2010. And as always, today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. And also be sure to follow us on Twitter with username CITRNews, and you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, please join us, as I said, on Friday at 5 p.m. for a special edition of News 101. I want to give a special shout out to Andrew Longhurst, who produced this radio program, and I'm, as always, Brad Pepink. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks so much for listening, and at 6 p.m., stay tuned for Career Fast Track. Again, this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and we leave you now with Groundwire.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News.
Grassroots news from coast to coast to coast.
In this edition, we focus on the perspectives and stories of First Nations communities with special features on the 20th anniversary of the so-called Oka Crisis, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, and more.
And that's important to me. Make sure that my children, my grandchildren, have a place that they can call their home, their homeland. Because this is our homeland. People keep trying to take our land even today.
I'm Lauren.
And I'm Jessica from CKUT Radio in Jojage, also known as Montreal.
First in national news.
In Ontario this week, a popular program to promote solar installations plunged into turmoil. The government program, which paid farmers and rural Ontarians up to 80 cents a kilowatt hour for energy they pumped back into the grid, recently announced it is reneging on that deal and offering rural, primarily ground-mounted solar installations at only 58 cents per kilowatt hour. Urban dwellers can still profit at the 80-cent rate for rooftop solar panels. Farmers and investors are calling it a breach of contract that discriminates against rural communities. Mike Art, a farmer in St. Mary's, generates solar power and installs panels and systems for others through New Horizon Energy.
Now that they've dropped the rate, it puts it down after maintenance and interest to about 4.5%. And basically, anybody who has that kind of money is not going to borrow at 4 and 5%. So I think the ground mount trackers and the ground mount fixed business is pretty much going to stop. Now that they've knocked back the price per kilowatt to 58.8 cents, that investment doesn't pay. And now that we have to go back to the roofs, and I mean, you're probably eliminating at least 80% of the people in the rural area for making that investment because they just don't have the proper roof to put it on. No one's decided to go forward at 58.8 cents for a ground mount, so we've actually lost customers that do have an offer to connect, but they just don't feel confident that the OPA will hold to the, you know, the contract or the agreement, and they feel the OPA has lost their integrity, and they're not willing to make that risk for, you know, 11-12% return.
Energy Minister Brad Duguid is allowing for a 30-day public comment period. Already, a petition promoted by microfitaction.com has collected over 500 signatures in 2 days.
This year, Walk for Justice is currently underway. The Walk for Justice continues in its tradition since 2006 to honor women who had died through violence or are still missing for over 40 years.
Participants are gathering signatures for a petition demanding a public inquiry and accountability in the cases the group has already presented to all the politicians and leadership nationwide. Many, if not the majority, of these cases are of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to missingjustice.ca, up to 3,000 Indigenous women have gone missing or been murdered in Canada since 1980. Of the 582 officially recorded cases, over 300 remain unsolved.
Gladys Radek, one of organizers of the walk, spoke with CKDU's Melissa Albiani last year on the urgency of the important walk.
It's time for all women to take a good look at what's going on around them and realizing that we as the life bearers of society have to start working together to stop this ongoing, what we call genocide. We know that violence sees no color, but we need people to start coming together and saying that this is not going to be accepted anymore and start, getting people to get these programs that are so much needed and start fighting for our funding for our women's programs because everything's being taken away.
The Walk for Justice started June 22nd from Kamloops, BC, and is set to arrive in Winnipeg July 28th.
Next, Joel Bard with news from Labrador and Quebec.
Innu, from Manimikush Lac Jean, a reserve near Schefferville, Quebec, continue to blockade two mines in western Labrador. Their blockade began on June 11th. And in a recent show of support for the protest, the Manimikush Lac Jean Innu have re-elected Riel McKenzie as their chief. Chief McKenzie says that the blockade will continue until fundamental land claim issues are addressed. These, he says, must occur at the provincial and federal level. Chief McKenzie wants the blockade to bring about an Innu land settlement in Labrador, one that includes Quebec Innu. As of now, Quebec Innu land claims in Labrador by either the provincial government of Newfoundland and Labrador or the federal government. McKenzie wants to see this changed. He says that his ancestors' territory encompassed parts of Labrador and included the land on which the blockaded mines sit. This is Joel Bard, reporting for Groundwire.
In other national news, Kootenay News in Nelson is a local newspaper being closed by Black Press. Catherine Fisher from Kootenay Coop Radio has this report on a community mourning the loss of its press.
Residents of Nelson, B.C. will lose their local daily newspaper on Friday, July 16th. The local paper of record, which has published in town for 109 years, was deemed unviable by Victoria-based purchaser Black Press. The press recently purchased a package of 11 newspapers previously owned by Glacier Media Corporation. Many locals in Nelson are upset about Black Press's decision. Andre Carroll, longtime radio and print commentator and author of the book Citizen Hall, Making Local Democracy Work, had this to say.
It's just one more step in a direction that I think we're going in this country in the marginalizing democracy. That's what it amounts to.
The Nelson Daily News has been operating in the red in recent years, but local readers and newspaper staff wonder why Black Press didn't consider keeping the paper publishing and scaling back on costs. Nelson Daily News publisher Peter Howey had this to say about how the loss of the paper will affect this small mountain community.
This doesn't allow a community to hear its stories. It doesn't allow it to hear the vital information that it needs to function. It doesn't allow it to dialogue with one another. That is going to be a tremendous loss for this community.
Black Press has also marked the Prince Rupert Daily Times, the Quinnell Advisor, and the 100 Mile Advisor for closure in the next short while. This is Catherine Fisher reporting from Nelson, B.C. for Groundwire. Thanks to Nelson Before 9 radio host Joanna Murata for files.
Welcome back to Groundwire Community Radio News, a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Our features this week give honor to the voices of Aboriginal peoples in Canada, or Turtle Island, and shine a light on their struggles. First, from Oka, Quebec, CKUT reports on the 20th anniversary of the defense of Ganastagi.
What did you think about walking through that moment where the defensive barricade was? What were you thinking about?
A lot of good memories to me because they represent our fight for equality and freedom. And, we made a decision a long time ago what we were going to do, and we did it.
There's a lot of things going through my mind. Like, I'm thinking of the regional reasons we started the camp in the first place, and you know, it was to protect the land. And it started off apolitical, and everybody was asked to leave their politics at the door and come and join us. And eventually, the small circle grew bigger. And well, you know what happened? July 11th happened. We couldn't obey the injunction because it was addressed to the band council. As traditional people, they don't speak for us. They don't represent us.
We've taken enough of this. It had to stop. And that barricade represents our strength, the resilience to go against anything, even guns. We didn't need weapons. We just needed our ceremonies and our spirit to be strong. That's all we needed.
I'm so proud of seeing you all here with us today. I'm proud of what I stood up for. I was one of many. I was a young man, but 1990 made me into a man who I am today. And I'm so proud to see the warrior flag across Canada, North America, and South America as a sign of Indigenous resistance. Yao Goa.
Canada, 300 years is too long to wait. We have a lot of work to do. My two small children are here with me today, and I hope that they're not here in 20 more years, marching because Canada hasn't lived up to its responsibilities, its treaty responsibilities to Indigenous peoples all across Turtle Island. This is an important day for all of us, but we have a lot of work left to do. Ambe Majada, let's go.
If we didn't stand up, the pines wouldn't be there. This community wouldn't be here. So if a small, quiet community like Ganastagi can stand up like we did in 1990, a lot of Native groups across the country can do the same thing. So never say never.
Do you see the pines here? That's what 20 years ago was all about that. What do you think if they would have built that golf course and this wouldn't be here? What would that mean to you?
I'm really sad because I have family that, you know, is buried there, and it's disrespectful to go right over.
One of the themes that's being brought forward today is that 20 years later, nothing has changed. How do you feel about that?
When it comes to the land issues, it's true, nothing has changed. When it comes to relationships between our nation and government, nothing has changed. When it comes to our people, we have changed.
In Native communities everywhere across this land, and Canadians, surprisingly, across this land, to stand up with you and sing you an honor song for everything you've gone through for the last 20 years. And we hope, oh, we hope that things change soon, because this is Mohawk land.
And that's important to me. Make sure that my children, my grandchildren, have a place that they can call their home, their homeland. Because this is our homeland. People keep trying to take our land even today.
20 years later, we're walking with a lot of kids today. Kids that weren't there.
Yeah. That brings that spirit back to me.
The nation is growing.
Yeah. My mother, she gave me that strength. She come to my legs and gave me the strength to run up that hill and welcome the Pines.
I've met many people from different nations, and there's always respect when you say you're from Oka, a Mohawk from Oka. It's like a big honor.
And now to the West Coast,
where Groundwire has been following the mucky trail of the Enbridge pipeline. After Enbridge announced its Northern Gateway pipeline expansion last month, the effects on the environment and the First Nations communities were effectively sidelined by Premier Gordon Campbell. From CJSR, David Caxan reports on the nearly unanimous opposition to Enbridge's expansion by 28 First Nations on the West Coast.
That's the sound of links of industrial pipe being welded together. If Calgary Energy Company, Enbridge, gets its way, it's a sound that might be ringing out across the hills of Alberta and British Columbia in only a few years' time. To oil industry workers, companies and shareholders, that sound represents dollars in the bank. To environmentalists, it's the sound of a future oil spill in the making. To some First Nations communities, it's the sound of territorial infringement and risk to their way of life. We investigate a proposal for one of Canada's biggest and most controversial infrastructure projects. Enbridge wants to build a pipeline from the refineries north of Edmonton to a specially constructed deepwater port, Kitimat, British Columbia. From there, the oil would be loaded onto supertankers, which would transit the Douglas Channel, a narrow stretch of water surrounded by the iconic Great Bear Rainforest, before heading out into the Pacific. The entire operation would move over 500,000 barrels of oil daily from the heart of Canada's oil patch to the lucrative markets in East Asia. Billions in benefits and hundreds of jobs, says Enbridge, but a growing number of opponents believe the benefits aren't worth the risks. Just weeks ago, Enbridge submitted its project proposal for assessment by the BC and federal governments. The company already has BC Premier Gordon Campbell on their side.
Billions of dollars of investment, thousands of jobs for people across the north, particularly for First Nations, build the capacity for First Nations that they've been asking us to build for a number of years now, and all of that will be done within an environmental framework that is secure for the long-term future of British Columbia.
However, not many British Columbians agree. A poll last month found 80% opposition to the heavy tanker shipping traffic that the project entails. More importantly, 28 BC First Nations have registered their opposition to the proposal, including every First Nation on the north and central coast. Last month, a super coalition of campaign groups took out a full-page advertisement in the Globe and Mail with a picture of the Exxon Valdez disaster and the words, "This was Exxon's gift to Alaska. BC can expect the same from Enbridge." One Aboriginal territory on the proposed route is the Nadir-Wutan First Nation. Representative Tara Marson spoke about her community's opposition.
First of all, there are significant impacts to be concerned about. Second of all, the number of jobs are low, and it's unlikely that they will go to local communities because of the skills requirements. And third of all, that the consultation process that the federal government has proposed is inadequate to deal with a project of this size, and it doesn't deal with Aboriginal rights and title effectively.
Inland First Nations also fear a spill. As Indigenous rights campaign of Amnesty International, Craig Benjamin explains, for many Aboriginal communities, environmental and social impact is closely related.
All of these rivers and streams are vital to the First Nations for activities that are central both to their cultural identity and have an ongoing importance to their economy.
From the perspective of Amnesty International, and for that matter the United Nations, the project should only go ahead if there is free, prior and informed consent from all Aboriginal groups affected. The project assessment by the federal government will take 2 years. Given current opposition, however, it is difficult to imagine that in its current form the proposal will win back First Nations support, regardless of the review.
Do you think a compromise is possible from where we are at the moment? There is very strong opposition to the project. Is there something Enbridge could do that could allay those concerns?
Our entry point is not the project per se. Our entry point is the fact that First Nations have at this point so clearly said that they don't want this project, at least a large number of First Nations said they don't want this project. So I think really the test for this is up to those First Nations themselves. You know, they are the ones who are in the best position to determine how their rights need to be respected. And I think it's important to point out that some of these nations, like the Carrier-Sokani Nation, have engaged with Enbridge. They have engaged with the project. They've carried out studies. They've carried out consultation and discussions within their own communities. So when they come and say, we don't want this project, they're not saying so as any kind of knee-jerk reaction. They're saying so on the basis of a lot of careful consideration, a lot of review of the data. So it's hard to imagine that there could be new information at this point that would come forward that would change that view. But really, of course, that's up to the First Nations themselves.
Clearly, Enbridge has a...